This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Electromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, we have double trouble. We have two gentlemen in the studio today. We're going to talk about cybersecurity and take a little bit different angle at cybersecurity. No more FISMA, no more FedRAMP, no more viruses and mobile managing devices. We're going to talk about cybersecurity from an acquisition perspective, and I think it's a good approach, a kind of unique way to talk about it. I was at an event at NVTC in December, and I saw these gentlemen talking about it. I said, geez, my listeners might want to get an idea of what this is all about, and so that's why I invited them in. But before we begin, let's talk about your background of each one. We have Emil Monette, and he is the Senior Advisor for Cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. We have Carter Schoenberg, Director of Cybersecurity Services at Caliber. Emil, tell us about your background, how you wound up at the GSA, please.
Sure. I've been in the federal acquisition workforce for about 15 years. Started out as a uniformed Air Force officer in a contracting office, and worked my way through a variety of policy and legislative positions to get where I'm at today.
And your LinkedIn profile says you're interested in surfing. Pretty tough to be in Fairfax County and surf, isn't it?
The water is cold. In the Potomac.
Pretty tough. And your background, please, Carter.
Certainly. 20 years combined experience between law enforcement, cybersecurity, and cyber intelligence. I actually started my career as a law enforcement officer, focusing on homicide investigations in DeKalb County, Georgia. Transitioned over to cyber crimes. Continued to evolve, starting with cybersecurity, cyber intelligence. Moved back to the Northern Virginia area about 3 years ago, providing support to a component within DHS, and most recently, a little over a year ago, came on board to Caliber to spearhead their cybersecurity practice.
And I think the focus of the discussion today is a report called Improving Cybersecurity and Resiliency Through Acquisition, kind of a different approach at cybersecurity here. Emil, paint the picture. Tell us a little about this report and how did it start, what originated at?
Sure. So on February 12th of last year, the president signed Executive Order 13636, and paragraph 8E, of that executive order required DOD and GSA to submit some recommendations to the president about how to incorporate cybersecurity, the words of the executive order were incorporate security into acquisition planning and contract administration. So we formed a group, DOD, DHS, NIST, GSA, of course, and we worked extensively with the stakeholder community through the associations, through public requests for public comment in the Federal Register, got some great input, and we submitted the report back in June to start the interagency review process, and that process ended in November. And one significant thing that I think is a win for the group and a testament to the good work that they did is that through that six-month interagency review process, there were no substantive changes made to the report. So we had the recommendations went out in draft in June to the stakeholder community, as well as getting submitted to OMB in the White House.
So, Carter, from 40,000 feet, there's a problem and a presidential directive to come up with a report and a solution, and this is what happens here. And it was signed in just a couple weeks ago, January 23rd, is that right?
That is correct.
And who are the people who signed it, and what's the next steps involved in this report? I think Hagel signed it, huh?
And you have two core stakeholders. You have Tangalini, and you also have Hagel. So you have representatives from federal civil side, as well as Department of Defense.
And so this is, I don't want to use too technical a term here, but this is Executive Order EO 13636, is that right?
That is correct.
And so if you're listening to this interview and it's 90 degrees outside, you can type in Executive Order 13636 and find all kinds of information. And this is really kind of a big promotion from the federal government. And this is really a significant report, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the thing that I find unique about what GSA has done as a result of this outcome is the fact that while the executive order has clear guidance and focuses on critical infrastructure, it has since been expanded to incorporate beyond just critical infrastructure. The government is now taking a holistic approach at looking at its commercial community that wants to conduct business with the United States government.
So, Emil, this wasn't something that just popped out of someone's head. There was a working group in place before all this executive order kind of was focused, wasn't it?
Loosely, yes. The same cast of characters that we have on the working group from those agencies that I mentioned, we were connected prior to the issuance of the executive order, working on a number of other related matters.
So when I think of acquisition, I think of buying, I'll throw this out, I've done a show on this, on buying spare parts and sourcing spare parts from China and finding out that there's malicious code in spare parts that are going into airplanes. I mean, I'm trying to think of a chain of command and something like this. And maybe this is something that instigated this whole resiliency through acquisition of all things.
That's a great point. So when we think about secure supply chain management, it's no longer just an issue on the chipsets and the hardware. We also have to be concerned about who are the service providers that supply those technology services to the United States government.
So, Emil, what is this concept CIP, and what is a CIP type procurement? What's non-CIP procurement?
It's an interesting question. Actually, during the process of writing the report and doing the stakeholder outreach and talking to our government counterparts that were not necessarily part of the working group, that question came up. Somebody called me and asked me one day, hey, can you look on the GSA schedules and tell me which companies support critical infrastructure? And I said, well, what do you mean by critical infrastructure? How do you define critical infrastructure? And really what that gets at from an acquisition perspective is the group recognized early on that acquisition is a dependency in all the critical infrastructure sectors, and even in sectors where you might not think it's critical infrastructure. We're buying the same IT products, whether it's chips in a sustainment mode that are going into an aircraft, or it's major systems. We're all buying that stuff from the same supply chains.
And I think what we found here in the report, and maybe it brings it up, is that this whole idea of critical infrastructure is not just the Pentagon, not just certain military bases. I mean, it's power plants all through the United States and communication systems, too. It's commercial, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, one of the best cases, and very timely, information recently came out in the past 24 hours that highlighted how the breach at Target took place, which was actually a direct tie back to industrial control systems. Industrial control systems are actively used in critical infrastructure.
So, I mean, I think this is a strategic approach at cybersecurity where it's not, okay, there's a breach, there's a problem, there's an incident, as they say, or an event, and let's fix it. It's trying to prevent the breaches from happening down the road.
Right. So it's forward-looking and saying, okay, if we want to prevent these incidents from happening, how do we have a little bit more structured approach, maybe elevate the importance of information security and information assurance in the acquisition process, and really look at how what we buy, those vulnerabilities or those threats, that risk that we buy, that we assume, lives on through the various life cycles. It's not just the acquisition life cycle. It's the sustainment life cycle. It's the disposal life cycle.
Spare parts, too. What's interesting about this is that the GSA got involved with the DOD and industry. It seems like these are not normal people you'd put together in the same room together, huh?
that's definitely not been the general course of action up until recently. That's actually how I was able to become involved with this particular process through the Professional Services Council back in January of last year. One thing I do think that is very important for your listeners to understand is, as Emil said earlier, the government was actively looking for a response from the public as well as the private sector. It was a direct result of inputs from the private sector that helped them come up with the baseline for their final report.
And this is why they have to get input from several, including the GSA and DOD and organizations like yours that might have a perspective that would enlighten them, huh?
Absolutely.
So the report comes out. Where can you access it, Emil, from GSA.gov, or where would you find this report?
It's on the GSA.gov website. It's also on the DOD website, under their news website.
Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about defining terms. And I think this whole idea of CIKR and CIP should be more defined and expand and talk about exactly where GSA fits in this and what's the practical steps that listeners can take in applying some of these concepts that are included in this report. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Emil Monette. He is a senior advisor for cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. And we have Carter Schoenberg. He's a director of cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have two gentlemen talking about kind of a different aspect on cybersecurity, about cybersecurity and acquisition. We're talking about a GSA final report that's just released a few weeks back. We have Emil Monette in the studio. He works at GSA. He's the advisor for cybersecurity at the GSA Office of Mission Assurance. And we have Carter Schoenberg. He's the director of cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems, kind of two individuals that were participants in developing this final report, as well as some folks from DOD. My question to you, Emil, is so what kind of products are we talking about? Is this software only? Is this firmware? Is this supplies? Made in the USA, made outside the USA? What kind of products are we talking about here?
Well, it's products and services, John. And it's important to note that the order of the recommendations in the report is not indicative of the sequence. Not all assets that are delivered through the acquisition system present the same level of cyber risk or therefore warrant the same level of cybersecurity controls. Furthermore, everybody is aware of this. The resources to address these acquisition cyber risks are scarce. And so the government really needs a risk-based, phased approach to addressing these risks. So the first recommendation that's going to be implemented is number 4, institute a federal acquisition cyber risk management strategy, because the other recommendations are dependent on the outcomes achieved during that process.
You know, when I think of risk management, I think of a financial risk management. But really, this is a financial risk management aspect, isn't it? I mean, it's just acquisition, it's finance, and risk management, I think of money.
No, absolutely. It's an economic analysis at a certain level, because if you're going to require higher levels of controls or higher levels of protection in the things that you buy, you're going to need to pay for that. And you can't do that across the board. You can't do a peanut butter spread there.
So, Carter, when this was being developed over the last year and a half, looks like you worked with other government agencies to develop some of these concepts. Tell us a little bit about how that all worked out the last year and a half.
Certainly. So over the past year or so, some of the core issues that we were trying to look at is, first off, when we're talking about cybersecurity, culturally, we have a tendency to want to sit there and say, well, it's overly burdensome. There's additional costs that are associated with this. And since we're talking about the commercial sector that is looking to do business with the United States government, how do we implement/incentivize the private sector to want to be able to meet these minimum thresholds? The challenges with defining what the minimum thresholds are is that there's an array of different standards. The most popular one that's currently used in the United States government is the NIST Special Publication 800-53. In its current iteration, there are 237 controls. Is it reasonable from a commercial standpoint to apply 237 controls to all commercial enterprises, whether they are small mom and pops, mediums, or large? That's one of these technical angles that the government is currently reviewing at this point in time. Right now, most recently in this past November, recent updates to the DFAR, the Federal Acquisition Rules, have codified 51 of these particular 237 controls that they are looking at as a baseline for a minimum barrier for entry that will be essentially monitored by the Department of Defense for making sure that the private sector that's doing business with them is actually adhering to that particular standard.
And Emil, this boils down to really 6 main aspects of this report. Is that right? I mean, the first one, I think, is conditioning the award on complying with these standards.
That's correct. But there's a fine point there, and that is once we determine what appropriate contracts are to include higher level requirements, then those requirements would be included in the technical specifications of the requirement itself.
Where does the training aspect fit in with this?
That's a great question. One of the other outcomes that came as a result of this final report is that the government acknowledged it's not enough to just sit there and say to the commercial sector, hey, we identified a risk and we want to apply A, B, and C updates to how you're going to conduct business with us. They turned the lenses back on themselves, identified areas where they could improve, and that is actually one of the core outcomes as a result of this final report. How does the government's contracting office, how does the contractor's workforce that supports the United States government, how do they better understand what cyber risk means to the government from a procurement standpoint? Not just in terms of we could have a potential data leakage or a breach, but also potential cost implications as a result of mitigating those risks.
So the training will take place by GSA or by private companies, or how's this all going to be implemented?
That's a good question. That's still under review by the United States government at this point. They're exploring a couple of different avenues, but I don't think that we have anything set in stone in terms of how they want to outline that yet.
Right. So, Emil, it's not really just assessments. It's developing compliance with these standards that...
Absolutely. So on the training recommendation there, we've got a working group formed now between Defense Acquisition University, the Federal Acquisition Institute, and the Homeland Security Acquisition Institute. And they're taking a look at all of the various content that we have out there in terms of awareness level training for cybersecurity that we can get a consolidated sort of curriculum for our acquisition workforce and push that out. As we develop these overlays, and I'll get into that in a moment, then that more specific training would be delivered to smaller groups of individuals in the acquisition workforce based on their specific role in the process.
I did a whole show on different aspects of training and how training has changed over the years from being formatted for desktop computers to tablets to smartphones. And the whole idea of training is just it's changing in of itself. So now we have standards that are changing, but the way that people want to consume them, people under 30 years old increasingly don't want to read a standard, a piece of paper. They may want to read it on an iPad on a train on the way home. So this whole concept of training, I think it's interesting that it's part of it because it's changing as well as the standards are changing too, aren't they, Carter?
That's absolutely correct. The mediums are currently being used depending on what type of generational element that you're looking at, whether it's baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, and now millennials. So as the government's moving forward, and I have the full faith and confidence that they are currently addressing this, you know, DHS has their virtual university, so there is implementation. There are mechanisms that are available for the U.S. government to hit the full SWAT between, like I said, baby boomers to millennials, whether you want an individual to take it in a classroom environment or if you want to do it virtually, whether it's cloud-based or for mobile applications.
Emil, there's an aspect of the six reforms called the FAR definitions. How's that changing and what's that got to do with this whole report?
Well, there's a balance there. So, you know, bottom line is uncertainty and ambiguity cost money. And you know, lots of my friends and colleagues on K Street make good money off of uncertainty and ambiguity. But to the extent that we can, we want to mitigate some of that misunderstanding that happens, you know, sometimes between the program office and the contracting office, sometimes between the solicitation and the contracting office and the commercial provider, the potential offer. So where we can, we want to define some terms in the FAR for contracts. And the balance is the terms tend to change. The cyber risk is dynamic. And we don't, you know, the regulatory promulgation process that we get definitions into the FAR with is not necessarily best suited to address that dynamic nature. So we want to probably reference some glossaries and things like that as well.
This sounds like a lot of lawyers getting involved in this process, in this particular step of the FAR. Is that true?
From the government's perspective, yes, it is. And from a legal standpoint, there is going to be potential additional implications as well for the commercial sector, because when we take into consideration, you now have a new check the box, if you will, for commercial industry that's wanting to do business with the United States government. There are adjacent benefits to organizations taking on these new evolution in addressing cybersecurity risk. When you take into consideration, let's say, underwriting for cybersecurity insurance, or potentially lowering your exposure level for a potential litigant action.
And I think when I went to your event back in December and you were speaking, I was sitting in my audience going, well, does this mean going to be more protests? Is that what this is going to lead up to? What do you think, Emil?
Well, we would hope not. I mean, you know, protests kind of, I think the volume of protests kind of keys in on economic conditions in the broader marketplace more so than a new definition in the FAR.
Specific definition this new one. Tell me about cyber risk management strategy. Here we go, risk management. It's one of the key concepts here.
Right. And as I said before, this is the central recommendation of this set of recommendations here. And the goal is to develop a common, repeatable, scalable process for addressing cyber risk in federal acquisitions based on, number one, the risk inherent to the product or service being acquired or purchased, and number two, the risk tolerance of that end user or risk owner. And so once the government specifically identifies which types of acquisition present cyber risk and then measures that risk, it can start prioritizing the scarce resources to address the acquisitions that present the highest risk.
And let's take a break. We can come back, talk more about scarce resources. And this may be a response to many agencies having scarce resources at the same time you have increased cybersecurity risk at the same time. And maybe this is a way to take standardize and make it a little bit easier for people to comply with some of these requirements. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Emil Monette. He is a senior advisor for cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. We have Carter Schoenberg. He's a director of cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking about cybersecurity from a different perspective. We're talking about acquisition reform and cybersecurity. In the studio today, we have Emil Monette. He's the director of Program Analysis Division at the GSA. And we have Carter Schoene. He's a technical director, cybersecurity diversity at Caliber Systems. And talking about many different aspects of a report that was issued in January of 2014. And we went through several different aspects of it. One aspect was the whole idea of scarce resources and cybersecurity risk management. I talked about risk management from a financial perspective. And Emil said, well, yeah, it is a financial perspective, but more than just that. You want to expand on that a little bit, Emil?
Absolutely, thanks. So the government's going to look at, you know, which types of acquisitions present cyber risk and measure that risk and then prioritize, because the resources are scarce to address this stuff, prioritize the different types of acquisition to address the highest risk types first. Once that prioritization is complete, the starting point, as I said, is the highest risk types of acquisition. And what we want to do there is build what we call overlays. And overlays is a term of art that is introduced in the NIST special publication 800-53. And it's selecting a specific set of risk mitigations. And in this case, we are adding procurement risk mitigations to the information security practices that are in 800-53. So you can think about choosing a set of security controls from 53, choosing different types of source selection criteria or evaluation methods. For example, when to use or not to use low price technically acceptable as a source selection method, your various pricing methodologies, and then contract performance indicators.
When I look at this report, I read part of it this morning, I keep thinking of Ben Franklin and ounce of prevention, pound of cure. He'd use it in different terms, I'm sure. But this is almost like, well, no, what you want to do is maybe take and make sure you have your seatbelt on before you drive to New York City. And I think what a lot of this is, it's preventing people from responding to an incident 6 or 8 months down the road. And from a financial perspective, this does reduce expenditures for cybersecurity incidents, doesn't it?
It does in the total lifespan of the thing that you buy. You know, it's always tough with federal dollars being appropriated year over year. You know, it's tough to get a budget owner or a program manager who's responsible for executing a budget to spend more money up front on something that, you know, they don't necessarily see a return on. And it's the same in the private sector. I mean, you know, the private sector runs on a 90-day cycle for ROI as well. And so to say to a corporation, you know, you need to invest more this 90 days and your return isn't going to come till, you know, 12 months out or something. It's a tough argument to make sometimes.
And the commercial role is, what have you done for me today?
Exactly.
Not even 90 days. Carter, your company is called Caliber, C-A-L-I-B-R-E, Caliber Systems. You can go to calibersys.com for more information. And you have a tool that assists with this risk mitigation. Is that right?
That's correct. It's called CARMA, Caliber's Acquisition Risk Mitigation Assessment. And essentially what this does is we walk through all of the 237 controls. And rather than trying to say, well, we're going to check the checkbox just for compliance sake, we realized that the fact of the matter is when you take into consideration organizations that have been breached most recently over the past several years, generally speaking, 80% of those organizations that have sustained a breach were quote unquote compliant. So coming back to some of the great work that's been done at DHS for their risk management framework, we've applied an assessment methodology that one, addresses the security controls that have the highest probability of causing a security event. From that point, we've then tailored it down to being able to understand out of those controls, which controls have the highest likelihood of either causing a formal sanction or potential litigant action. The outcome as a result of this assessment is enabling our customers to understand, here are the findings, here is the cost to remediate those findings as it stands right now versus incident response.
In my world, they're called SDOs, Standards Development Organizations, and a lot of lively debates in those organizations about a lot of details here. And so in the break, we talked about ISO 27000, and I think this is maybe you combine that with some federal regulations to maybe achieve a more efficient risk assessment. Is that right?
So when you take into consideration the standards that are out there, the ISO 27000 series, which focuses on information security and risk management, actually, in their appendix section, there is a crosswalk that maps each of their controls back to an 853 control
that's similar in nature. That's where it fits in for the federal government. So the SDO for that would apply, and that would be a better application rather than someone tossing out HIPAA and PCI and throwing those out and having some implication. They have something to do with security. I can't see how it fits in, but people throw that out, won't they?
They certainly will. And when you take into consideration organizations that are out there that are saying that they're PCI compliant, the PCI standard is very stringent. The challenge, though, is the fact that that particular standard only is applicable for computing elements that maintain, transmit, or store credit card data. When you take into consideration the HIPAA standard, while, again, they have very direct and clearly defined controls, even those controls directly pull back to the 853 series.
You know, Emil, I'm a lot older than you, and I remember a TV show called Who Do You Trust? Johnny Carson was the host. And I think this is one of the aspects of this report is trusted vendors or trusted sources. And how does this all fit in?
Absolutely. So one of the recommendations is that for certain types of high-risk acquisition, the government would be required to purchase from original equipment or component manufacturers or their authorized distributors. So just that on its face is a pretty it's a pretty big limitation on competition, which, you know, is a core principle of the federal acquisition system. So there is a process in the FAR already. It's called qualified bidders list. And so what we said in the recommendation is what we want to do is understand why the authorized distributor relationship is preferred. So there are terms and conditions that those distributors enter into with the original manufacturers. The government needs to understand and distill out what the highest common denominator is amongst those within a market segment, and then make those things the criteria for being listed on this qualified bidders list. And that qualified bidders list would be open to all companies, small, medium, large.
When we look at these six aspects, what kind of costs do you think would be involved in just in complying with those? Any at all? Reduce costs, increase costs for vendors?
No question there's going to be increased costs where there's increased security requirements. I mean, anybody that says differently is not being entirely truthful. The life cycle cost is reduced, where you have avoidance of incident response costs. But the initial costs are going to be more in certain circumstances. And that's why we need this phased risk-based approach. It's really about looking at, well, of all the things that I buy, I buy paper clips. Do I need a cyber risk assessment on my paperclip vendor? Maybe not. But I buy, IT network gear. Do I need a cyber assessment there? Probably. But there's lots of different, there's lots of real estate in between there, lots of different types of acquisition. So we really need to understand what that prioritization is and be able to devote the scarce resources where they're best, where they're going to get the best bang for the buck.
Carter, if you walk into any federal agency, you'll see all kinds of mobile devices and changing new equipment. I'm sure a year from now, you'll see new different types of mobile devices. And so a lot of these principles, they have to almost be subject to 6-8 month reviews and constant adjustments because there's new technology coming out there and changes just constantly in the world of technology.
That is absolutely correct. DHS and both DOD have very stringent practices on how they address their service development, pardon me, their software development lifecycle. How they review their technology. They have very clearly defined lists on who the approved vendors of choice, if you will. And that is usually defined by a common criteria rating, which for your listeners is an independent review of a technology to validate at what level did this particular independent assessment evaluate its security or cybersecurity fidelity levels.
Emil, the introduction is number 10 in the field, but number 1 in the hearts. Number 6 on this list is increased accountability. Where does this fit in with this whole report?
So the group analogized the legal review process. You don't find a lot of contracting officers in the federal government and certainly in private sector as well running around signing contracts without getting a legal review. We want to elevate the role of the information security workforce in the acquisition lifecycle so that they are engaged directly during requirements definition, during pre-solicitation, during source selection, and during post-award, and during disposal, you know, post-award and closeout. And so we're going to establish some specific milestones and sign-offs around accountable individuals in those processes.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about what's going to happen in the next 4 to 5 years and how this is going to impact procurement and cybersecurity, and ask more about national security and fiscal impacts of some of these changes in cybersecurity. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Emil Monette. He is a senior advisor for cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. And we have Carter Schoenberg. He's a director of cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio today, we have Emil Monette. He is a senior advisor for cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. And we have Carter Schoenberg. He is a director for cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems. That's spelled C-A-L-I-B-R-E, Caliber Systems. And we talked about both organizations several times. Talking about cybersecurity and acquisition reform, and many people are listening to this live. Some people are listening to this online in 2015. And some people like to read blogs and tweets. And I'll be blogging about this. My blog is called the Tech Tuesday Blog. And I'll talk about this interview we've had. And are there blogs you can recommend for our listeners, Emil, that they may want to read and keep up with these changes?
I like the Fed News Radio blogs. I read those pretty frequently. I do the occasional guest blog on some blogs for friends, but I don't have a personal blog myself.
Do you have any blogs you read that you think might be of value for our listeners, Carter?
Absolutely. So you have the CSO online, Chief Security Officer Online blog. There is a column that's usually supported by Dan Lorman, who is the State of Michigan's Chief Security Officer, who provides great content. And you also have Tripwire's State of Security.
You know, I found that a lot of the state level security folks really are down on the and they know what's going on, and sometimes they have their hands on things a lot quicker than other people do. And it's a matter of being closer to the technology. I have a Twitter account. I am at Ray Gilray. You can follow my tweets about this. I'm sure there's a lot of Twitter activity out there. What I'd like to do now is I give everyone of my guests a 10 question test to see if in fact they're a card carrying nerd. And we're going to start with you, Emil. And we have 10 questions here. We're going to find out a little technical details of your background to see if you're a nerd or not. How many desktops do you have in your house right now if I broke in today?
Zero.
Zero. Well, that's the right answer. How many cell phones have you bought in the last year?
One.
One. Okay. Do you have a personal Twitter feed?
I do.
Okay. Do you have a personal blog?
I do not.
And do you use any personal online backup services?
I use Google Drive and Dropbox.
What kind of smartphone do you have?
iPhone 5.
Okay. And how many apps have you used in that in the last 30 days?
Probably about 18.
Interesting. I used to always ask if they had tablet devices. Now the question is, how many tablet devices do you have at home?
I have one.
And what social networking sites are you active in?
I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter.
Last book you read was electronic or paper?
I'm reading one of each right now.
Oh, that doesn't count. The last book you finished then.
Last book I finished was electronic.
Electronic. Well, Carter, you're going to have to beat him on this. I don't know if you can or not. Desktops in your house. How many desktops do you have fired up there?
Zero.
Zero. Okay, that's the right answer. It's increasing. It was prestigious years ago to have them. Now, not anymore. How many cell phones have you bought in the last year?
Two.
I've had people buy 6 and 7. It's just incredible. I can't believe it. Do you have a personal Twitter feed?
I do not.
Okay. You have a personal blog?
I do not.
Okay. What kind of online personal backup do you use?
Right now for media feeds, I'm using LinkedIn, and I also use for data backup, I use Google as well as Dropbox.
Okay. And what kind of smartphone do you have?
Android platform.
Okay. And how many apps have you used in that in the last 30 days?
Probably 10.
Okay. How many tablet devices do you have at home?
One.
And what social networking sites are you active in?
LinkedIn.
And last book read, electronic or paper?
Electronic.
Well, this is a very interesting little combination there. I'll have to go through my UNIVAC computer and print out something and find out exactly who the card-carrying nerd is or not. I'm always fascinated by these answers because I've had people with NAS systems in their basement. Oh yeah, back in my own city, I have a home network with 15 nodes. It's always fascinating. And some people wouldn't expect to have that much technical knowledge at home. It's hard to predict what's going to happen. And when this report came out, it's more of a high-level report, isn't it, Emil? And it's just making suggestions for the next step. So what's going to happen with this report, and what are the next steps in the next 12 to 18 months with these suggestions?
Sure. So the recommendations are exactly that. They are recommendations from the Secretary of Defense and the Administrator of General Services to the President about what should we do with regard to acquisition and cybersecurity. So the next steps, you know, the report does a decent job of laying out the what, you know, what should we do. The next step is really figuring out in a higher degree of detail the how we do those things. And so we're going to continue with the open collaborative process that we use to generate the recommendations. We're going to have requests for public comment in the Federal Register, the first of which is going to come out later on this month, and it's going to be focused on that fourth recommendation, the risk management strategy. But really, it's about engagement and getting the right smart people to give us the good input that they have.
So, Carter, you're active in the community here. I'm sure you've gotten feedback on this. You think this is going to come up with some original new ideas in the 4 to 6 months? Has everything been hashed out, or where do you see this whole discussion happening with these ideas?
I think from a building block perspective, the core baseline has been well established. I think that what we will see over the next 4 to 6 months are some, you know, you will most likely have two sides on a fence line. You'll have one that will sit there and say, yeah, well, it makes sense, and we're pretty much halfway there anyway, so let's go ahead and move forward. You will have another side of the fence that will sit there and have reservations because of the inherent costs that will be associated with these enhancements to their cyber hygiene, if you will. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that precedent has already been established by the government in an adjacent type of capacity. Last year, with the omnibus rule for HIPAA, the government has, in fact, applied security standards to business associates to healthcare facilities. So from an adjacent perspective, there's an academic argument that this is already in place. And for those of your listeners that are not familiar, Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights is handing out $1 to $1.5 million fines like it's candy on Halloween.
So I think what the government has to take a look at is what their priorities are. Is it a priority national security, or is it financial risk impact to businesses in applying some of these? And this is, I think this is what the open process is going to involve. People are going to chime in on comments on this and say, well, no, maybe we should emphasize this more. I mean, I think it's going to respond a whole lot differently with what happens in the next 30, 40 days, probably with the events. Where do you think this is going to happen, Emil?
Well, I think, it's stepping back a little bit. I think it's about establishing trust in those that we do business with. And it's the government doing that, and it's companies doing that as well. And so in certain types of buying, you need to trust the deliverable, whether it's a product or a service. In other types of buying, you need to trust the deliverable, and you need to trust the process. So you talked about the ISO standards, and those are process standards. In other types of buying, you need to trust the deliverable, the process, and the company. And so that's the ownership structure. Who owns it? Where's the financing coming from? And then who is the supply chain, and what do they do, and who owns them, and all that stuff.
Google is begging me to do two-factor authentication, and I'm resisting it. And there may be some people who trust two-factor authentication and maybe say, well, this is really an important aspect of cybersecurity. Mixed results in even something as simple as that, isn't there, Carter?
That's a very good point. One thing that we do that take in consideration is, generally speaking, the weakest link is not technology. It's usually the human being. Case in point, over the past few years, there was a very large OEM whose core business was selling two-factor authentication. And unfortunately, they even sustained a breach. So when we talk about, what is the bottom line impact going to be on the commercial sector, both public and private sector organizations agree there has to be some way to be able to incentivize the private sector to be able to take on these new initiatives. When you take into consideration the past example with the two-factor authentication, while both public and private sectors did not incur a direct cost for the replacement of that technology, there were, in fact, logistical costs, and those logistical costs were quite sizable. So again, when we take into consideration how does an organization evaluate risk as it pertains to whether it's cyber or operational in nature, we've been hearing the same bandwagon response for over a decade now. More money is being spent on cyber today than ever before. Logic should dictate that our risk posture is getting better, and it's not. So ultimately, we had to ask ourselves the question, do we fault the players or do we fault the model? That's the core reason why Caliber came up with this particular model for providing a security assessment.
What's GSA's role going to be as a facilitator for the discussion? Obviously, if they're involved in this report, they're going to have to be involved in reaction to this discussion, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. So, we co-chair the working group that is figuring out the how in terms of implementing the recommendations. But we need to apply those recommendations and implement those recommendations in our own operations as well, and that will begin to happen.
We'll have to keep an eye on what kind of response this gets in the next 6-8 months, and maybe in a year come back in and evaluate what happened and what the next step is. I think all agencies are getting squeezed. They're getting forced to do more with less. They're getting staff reduction and increased threat environment here, and maybe some of these suggestions can be applied to reduce costs for cybersecurity for agencies in the future. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we're talking about acquisition and cybersecurity reform. We have Emil Monette. He's a senior advisor for cybersecurity, GSA Office of Mission Assurance. And we have Carl Schoenberg in the studio here, director of cybersecurity services at Caliber Systems. Thank you, gentlemen.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk, Tuesday mornings at 9, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.